Again, I don't even believe he was God. Now that's as far as it goes. It makes really no impact on his life. He has a mental agreement with something. That's it. Most of my life, I grew up thinking that's what it took. That's all it is. If I can mentally agree with what people have told me about Jesus, that makes me a Christian. When I came to this verse and came to understand other things about the New Testament, I started to doubt that. Now I really doubt it. Because I don't think believing the right things about Jesus is enough. And this was super important for me. Because what is faith? How does the Bible define faith? We talk about saving faith. We talk about it all the time. We love that, and it's great. But if you look at faith, you look at Hebrews 11, 1, it says, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, so hoped for. Now, my brother doesn't look at that as anything. Faith to him is he just believes the right things about Jesus that happened in the past. But this faith in Hebrews 11, 1 is talking about things hoped for. In Hebrews 11, 6, a little bit later, they talk about faith is without faith is impossible to please God, because you have to believe that he exists and that he is the rewarder of those who seek him. He is a rewarder of those who seek him. When? In the future. So for me, understanding this and a lot of other things made me realize faith, one way of saying it is faith is primarily future-oriented. Now, I did not like this growing up, and I did not like hearing any of this when I first heard this, by the way. I was arguing in my mind. This was a John Piper thing. He was trying to teach us this stuff, and I was here. No, I did not like it. And I'll explain later why that happened. But one of the things he pointed out was if we're only looking back and our faith is only believing the right things about Jesus, and that's it, like my brother, if you ask them, if you're thinking that way, what is the motivation for Christian obedience? Well, you're pretty much left with one thing, and that's gratitude. And I can say, oh, I should be obedient to God because God has done so much for me. He's done everything I need. God has done all of this for me, and so now I'm responsible to live for him. Now, there's a lot of truth in that. And you hear theologians do this all the time. They'll talk about gratitude as being the primary motivation for Christian obedience. Well, John Piper pointed out, nowhere in the Bible is gratitude ever explicitly given as a reason for Christian obedience. Nowhere. And he said, the Bible has a lot to say about gratitude, has a lot to say about obedience. And I'm not down on gratitude. If you're not grateful, I don't see how you're a Christian. In reality, I don't see it. But is that your motivation for obedience? Because it turns into, and I felt this growing up, and I know I felt this growing up, if I'm supposed to be doing stuff for God because all he's done for me, now I owe it to him. To be obedient now because he's done this for me, I owe it to him. And it never worked. Like, I never felt enough of the grace. I never felt that. And I was so happy to be when I finally was freed from this. Because think about what Jesus said. Never did he tell the disciples, oh, ye of little gratitude. What was it? It was, oh, ye of little faith. We're never told to walk by gratitude. We're told to walk by faith. And now faith is future-oriented. Faith, another way of saying it, faith is trusting in the promises of God. We sang about this. This is awesome. And this is important for me to get. Because the cross and the resurrection, I mean, everything hangs on the cross and resurrection. I'm not trying to be down. I'm not trying to put it down in any way when I'm saying that that's like the looking back is not the best way or whatever. My life hangs on the cross. The cross and resurrection, most important events in all of history. No doubt. But I don't think that we're expected to believe only in the cross and the resurrection, and then that's it. I think we're supposed to look at the cross and the resurrection and say, God did all that for me. I can now trust him to keep his promises for me in the future. And if you look at Romans 8:32, that's exactly what Paul says. He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all. The cross, the resurrection. How will he not also with him freely give us all things in the future? It's trusting in those promises. The logic is, if God would do all that for you, such a huge price to pay for you, why don't you trust him to freely give us all these things for your future, everything you need? And that's when the promises of God became very important to me. I used to make mentally, not verbally, but mentally sort of criticize my grandmother because her theology, she didn't know very much about the Bible. She didn't know very much about things. If it helps, I mean, I don't know, maybe you know, but back in the 80s with Jim Baker and the PTL and the televangelists, she was one of those people giving money to these ministries. But by her bed, and this would be my mental mocking her, she had this little book called The Promises of God. And in my arrogance and stuff, I would just see that and think, well, that's all she's got. What does that have to do with anything? She needs to stop giving money to these people who are obviously fakes. I have that book now, The Promises of God. I got it from her. I kept it. And I love it. And I realize now her faith was simple and maybe not as informed as it could have been and whatever. But she loved Jesus, she trusted Jesus, and she trusted in those promises. And I'm now on her side. I'm like, that's awesome. I still, not the Jim Baker thing, but like the trusting the promises. It turned into all that. So, okay. And now for me, I think, well, what promises should I be believing? What promises should I be trusting? Like, because the Bible is full of promises. Every page is about promises for us. And if we're not trusting in them, then that's not really, in my opinion, that's not saving faith. That's not faith, because we need to be pursuing promises of God. And my favorite one is Isaiah 41:10. So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed. I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my victorious right hand. I can walk into any situation with that promise. If that's going through my head, I can handle it because I'm trusting that promise. God is going to be there. Well, the Bible has promises like this all over the place, and nobody ever taught me that that's what I need to be focusing on. My grandmother knew it. She didn't know much else, but she knew that. And so when we talk about faith, you know, there's this the whole idea about there are three aspects of faith. If you, like, the chair is a great example. You've probably heard of this before, but it's trusting in the chair is the main thing. You can say, well, I believe that's a chair. I can agree with you that the chair, and you say, well, do you believe that it can hold somebody up? Yes, I believe it probably is structurally sound to hold people up. Okay, I can mentally agree with these things. Well, then sit in the chair. That's where the trust is. So that's a classic example of faith theologians like to use. But I think Jesus actually adding something is, do you come to the chair? Now, this is where the analogy breaks down a little bit, but do you come to the chair for your satisfaction? Do you come to the chair because you love that chair? And, of course, the analogy breaks down, but we're talking about God here. The God would be the chair in this situation. And Jesus is inviting us to find our joy and our satisfaction in him. This is a promise to us. Because guess what? You're going to find your joy and satisfaction in something. You're going to pursue your happiness as best you can in something. Have you ever thought about this? The whole world is on a massive quest for happiness. But we, as Christians, we're given we know the true source of joy and happiness. Now, there are people who don't like the word happiness. I know that. And I think, well, happiness is what the world might be able to get, but we, as Christians, we have joy. There may be something to that. Maybe. But That's a more recent distinction, by the way. Early 1900s is when those two words started to be defined differently, and the Bible uses them interchangeably. So I don't know about distinguishing them that much. But we have the greatest news of all, because the world is seeking happiness. They're just seeking it in the wrong places. They're seeking after... I mean, why does anyone do drugs? Why does anyone drink too much? Why does anyone do these things? Because they think those things will make them happy, even if it's just for a moment. A lot of times we're just trying to numb out our unhappiness. But when God is saying, come to me, I am your bread of life. Or I am your fountain of living water. He's saying, come to me for these things. And that's how, by the way, I mentioned before, that's how you fight sin. Why do we sin? Why do we choose to do that? Why do I ever sin? Because sin makes promises that I will be happier if I just do this. You go back to the Garden of Eden. You go back all through the Bible story. Why are we choosing these things? Because we think that'll make me happier. The Bible calls it deceitful desires. Lies and deceit. And God's saying, pursue me and I will be your happiness. I will be your joy. Now, is this the only verse that talks like that? Not exactly. How about Psalm 37:4? We love this one. It's a command, by the way. Delight yourself in the Lord. He will give you the desires of your heart. Delight yourself. That's a command. That's kind of crazy. Or if you look at Psalm 1, one of my favorites, we know this one. Blessed is the man. By the way, the word blessed there means happy in Hebrew. And it may mean more than that, but it's not less than that. It's happy. Happy is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, stand in the way of sinners, or sit in the seat of mockers. Like, we know that part. Happy is the man who doesn't do these things. Why? His delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. It's so easy to turn that into duty, to say, I have to meditate on the law day and night. It's my job. It's what I'm supposed to do. But, and I've heard sermons about this, where it turns into a guilt trip, because I don't usually do that. But the whole point of it is his delight is to do these things. His delight is in the law of the Lord. It's no longer... in the first part of the verse, the sitting in the seat of mockers and all that. That's what it used to be. But his delight is in the law of the Lord. So I'm telling you, pursue your joy. Pursue your happiness. There's nothing, we're not supposed to like oppress that in our lives. We're supposed to pursue it. I love that about C.S. Lewis. He made that point super well. When he talked about we are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with sex and drink and ambition and all those things, when infinite joy has been offered to us, we're like half-hearted creatures. He says we're like a child playing in the making mud pies in the slums, because we can't understand what is meant when somebody offers to us a holiday on the beach. That's basically the idea. And I feel like that's what I'm doing. When I'm messing around with all the sin and stuff, it's not going to be satisfying. It's never really going to keep the promises. And God says, either you find your joy, your happiness, your satisfaction in me, or you die in your sins. And I never heard this stuff growing up. I heard a whole lot of, this is what you do. You do what's right, for right's sake, because it's the right thing to do. And I always had this idea that, well, I'm supposed to glorify God. I'm supposed to obey God. But I want to be happy too. And these things were competitive in my mind. Like, I knew I wanted to be happy. I knew what I wanted to do was not always what was over here. Or at least I thought it wasn't. And I had a whole lot of rebellion and big trouble in my teen years and beyond and all those things. There was a big battle going on, and it wasn't until I was getting this. These things are not competitors in the universe. God tells you, pursue your joy in him. And you'll be obeying him, and you'll actually be glorifying him. Now, when I first heard the whole glorifying thing, I had a problem, because I was like, hold on, that's a... mm-mm. Because I knew man's chief end, you glorify God. And all this other stuff I was hearing was you're supposed to be happy. And I couldn't connect the two in my brain. And it wasn't, and again, I'll go back to this is another John Piper thing where he explained, God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him. Okay, you can say that, but how does that really work? And he gave the example that made me stop arguing with him mentally. And actually, I thought he might be onto something. He gave us a little example, and I'm about to close here. He said, I can imagine coming up on my 30th wedding anniversary. This was 20-something years ago. He's a lot older now. But he said, coming up on my 30th wedding anniversary, I can imagine coming home and knocking on the door. My wife comes to the door, and she's like, what are you doing knocking on the door? Because he goes, usually I just walk on in. But I knock on the door this time. She answers it, and I'm standing there, and I got flowers behind my back, and I say, happy anniversary, Noel. Go up and get changed into a nice outfit, because I got reservations at your favorite restaurant for tonight, and I got a babysitter lined up, because they had just adopted a one-year-old girl. But anyway, your babysitter and all the rest, because we're going out tonight. And she says, thank you so much. Why did you do all this for me? And he says, because I read in a book that on your anniversary, you should take your wife out to dinner. He said, now what is she going to say to that? She's going to say, I'm not going with you. That's the wrong answer. Now that's duty. He was doing what he was told to do. He thought, in that scenario, he thought that's the right thing to do. And then when I heard John Piper say this, he was looking at us. This was First Presbyterian Church in Macon, Georgia. He said, why are you here on a Sunday morning, First Pres Macon? Is it because you know the Bible says, let us not forsake the gathering of ourselves together? Is that your primary motivation for being here? And I was like, whoa, that's what I've grown up always thinking. We're supposed to be there. You got to go to church because that's what they are. The doors are open. We're there because you're supposed to be there. But then he made the real connection. He said, now just imagine the same scenario. Come home, flowers, go get changed. I got the restaurant reservations, the babysitter, everything's lined up. We're going out on a town. And she says, thank you so much. Why are you doing all this for me? And I say, because nothing would make me happier than to spend tonight with you. And it was never, what's she going to say to that? The right answer, okay. Because never in a million years is she going to look at me and say, oh, nothing makes you happier? Why don't you think about me sometimes? But his answer, he's like, why not? Why isn't she accusing me of being selfish? Am I not pursuing my own happiness, my own joy? When I'm talking like this, I'm saying I'm doing this because I'm pursuing my joy, my happiness. He said, why doesn't she accuse me of being selfish in that sense? Because by me being happy in her and wanting to be nowhere else but with her, I'm elevating her. I'm raising her up. She's feeling lifted up. And in biblical terms, I'm glorifying her by doing it that way. When he said that, that's when the light clicked. Wait a minute. Maybe he was onto something. I still wasn't convinced at the time, but then he was giving a whole week-long series at the church in Macon, so I asked him to send me every tape there is that he says, and it's taken years, but I have been processing this, and one of the things he did talk about was Jesus being the bread of life, and he was explaining this to me, and then others have too. And there are other verses, we're going to end with some of these. I already talked about delight yourself in the Lord. If you look at Psalm 42 and 43, they used to be one psalm, by the way. The whole thing is about being sad and overwhelmed with grief. And then there are all these throughout there. Every now and then, there's a statement of some hope, but it's why are you cast down, O my soul? It's those words. But then towards the end of it, he says his answer to his grief is, I will go to the altar of God, to God, my exceeding joy. In the Hebrew, there really says, to God, the happiness of my rejoicing, like the center of my rejoicing. Is that what I do when I'm... Do I think of God that way? Do I ever think of God as like an answer to my grief? Or how about Psalm 36:7? How precious is your steadfast love, O God. The children of mankind take refuge in the shadow of your wings. That's beautiful. And it says, they feast on the abundance of your house, and you give them drink from the river of your delights. Or we know Psalm 16:11. You make known to me the path of life. In your presence is the fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. I never thought of God this way before. Apostle Paul knew this. He tells us to rejoice always, no matter what. Rejoice. He also says things like, even though we're sorrowful, it's sorrowful, yet always rejoicing. Now, these kind of things make no sense to the world. That whole mindset, you can be sorrowful and rejoicing, makes no sense to the world. Now, none of this of what I'm saying has anything to do with like health, wealth, and prosperity, by the way. I'm not saying you're going to be happier because you have more money or whatever those things. None of that. All right? The biblical call is in many ways a call to suffering. Jesus said, follow me, you'll take up your cross. You'll follow me. But that's not the end of the story. For anyone who wants to find his life will lose it. And anyone who loses his life for my sake will find it. Well, that's what we want. That's what we're talking about here. Even Hebrews said Jesus went to the cross. Why? For the joy that was set before him. That's hard for me to wrap my mind around, but it's there. It was Jesus's point. One of his motivations was joy was in front of him. I think he knew that whatever he did, if it was not the Father's will, he would not be pursuing his own joy in true satisfaction. He followed his Father's will all the time. Okay. This is what I mean by saying Jesus did not only come to give bread, but to be bread. All right. Jesus has made us righteous through faith. We got all that. We understand through faith. And he intends for us to find our deepest joy and satisfaction in this life in him and not the things of this world. So this is what I'm saying. This is how I'm fighting sin. This is the only way I've ever been even closely successful in fighting off sin, certain sins especially. Because I understand that's not really going to make me happy. He is. And I want to pursue my joy and satisfaction in him more than anything else. Because I'm taking the superior promises of God to fight these other promises that don't ever really work. Because I want him to be my bread of life. I want to see him as my fountain of living water, my joy and my true satisfaction. Now, the last little thing, I'm not going to spend much time on this one at all, I promise. But if God offers himself to you as your fountain of living water and your bread of life, and you say, no thanks, I can accept you as like a commander in chief. I can accept you as like the leader of an army, and I can follow you from that sense. Then you're not really believing. You're not trusting. You can say, I'll go to other things for my joy and satisfaction, the internet or my phone or even other people or whatever. That's what the world is doing. And you may also be saying, okay, this whole joy satisfaction business, or you may run into other people who believe this way too. Well, that's great for you, but you don't know me. You don't know what I've been through. That's for people who don't have cancer, or that's for people who don't have a loved one, a parent or something, who's lost a loved one. That's only for those kind of people. You can't teach us this way. because that doesn't really work for me. I think I would have said that at some point growing up, probably. Not great for you, dude. But I can tell you from personal experience, because 13 years ago, when my wife and I moved back from Mexico, we were missionaries, that's where we met, but then we moved to Mississippi from Mexico. Did not plan to be in Mississippi very long, but we're still here. We got pregnant, our first child. It was awesome. Our first year of marriage, by this point, we were like into our second year of marriage, pregnant. We were like, this is amazing. This is awesome. And 4 months into the pregnancy, we got the diagnosis that she has something called trisomy 18. We had never heard of it. So they said it's also called Edwards syndrome. That didn't help because we still hadn't heard of that one. But basically, it's a very similar thing to Down syndrome, which is trisomy 21, except trisomy 18 is always terminal. So our first child, they're telling us 4 months into the pregnancy that she'll probably not even make it to term, because 90% don't. It'll either be like a stillbirth thing, probably. So every time we went to the doctor, at first you go once a month and all that, when we heard the heartbeat in there, we had this huge celebration. I had a problem with the huge celebration because I was having a hard time investing emotionally into something that I was not going to be able to ever meet, probably. So we got farther along, had more of those little celebrations and stuff. We got to where she might actually make it to term. So we started praying. Well, we want to meet her. We'd like to get her baptized, if possible. And we'd like to take her home from the NICU. First of all, we did get all three. She did make it to term. She actually lived for 167 days, which was way more than they said she would ever make it. And God did amazing things through her life, by the way, through a blog that my wife had started years ago. Anyway, thousands of people started reading about her through this blog that we thought nobody would ever read. But my wife was just writing stuff to help herself process this stuff and did not expect anybody to actually look at it except her mother and her sisters. She wanted them to read the blog so they quit asking her how she's feeling every day. All three of them would ask separately. She's like, just read what I wrote and just stop asking. That was for them, not for everybody else. But over time, we saw like thousands of people were coming to this blog to read my wife's feelings and thoughts about having a baby with a terminal illness. And my wife finally said, you better start contributing because it's getting to be a big thing. And so people all over the world started reading about that, about her, even before she was born. And we started getting comments from people all over the world about how they would say things like, my walk with Christ is stronger because of your journey and things like that. I feel closer to God because of you. And finally, I think this is after she was born, but before she died, someone in France, some girl in France wrote, I've been reading this blog for months and I've never commented before, but I want you to know that I've been running from the Lord for years, but I've turned my life over to Christ because of your little girl. And that's amazing. It's God's story. It's not her story. It's not my story. This is God graciously showing us a little bit of his plan in the world. But I also know the months and years after her. I held her in my arms when she died. There's nothing like that. There's nothing like dealing with that. Isaiah 41:10 got me through the next week. It got me up in the morning. Do not fear, I'm with you. Do not be dismayed. I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. My wife will attest to this too. We have tasted so much joy, even through the pain, even through hardships. We both of us feel closer to each other and much closer to God because of this. And it has been amazing to see. We do taste a little bit of what Paul meant when he said sorrowful, yet always rejoicing. And there's a lot to that. It's not just for the people who have lived an easy life. This is not what this is about. Jesus certainly didn't. I want to know what it means to pursue the bread of life and to know his satisfaction for my soul. And that's what I'm commending this morning. And I'm sorry if I didn't make much sense on some of this stuff, but hopefully we'll walk out of here differently. And I just ask the Lord to use it. Let's pray. Lord, please use what we've looked at. I want to know what this really means, and I thank you that you promise to be our God, to take care of us, that you love us, and that you are good. Even through the difficulties of this life, we know you're sovereign, even over those things. Lord, thank you for the word and that you can open our eyes and change our hearts so that we don't look like the rest of the world who's pursuing all these things that will never satisfy. May we always look to you as our true joy and satisfaction and our bread of life. In Jesus' name, amen.